24th, not the 17th. We'll still be in Israel on the 17th. But, okay.
Sure.
We need a... No, no, I have everything you need.
Okay.
All right, I have... So, the schedule has us... And today is Hanukkah. For Hanukkah, good. So we're working with our proper schedule. You taping me? I'll send it to Richard. Thanks. Thank you. Okay, today is December 13th, and we are in the third of a series on how the holidays are represented in Tanakh. We started with Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Then we did Sukkot, and today we're doing Hanukkah, just in time. A little more than a month from now, we'll do Tu B'Shvat, which will be just around the time of Tu B'Shvat. We're going on a great schedule. So let's start with Hanukkah. Now, obviously, if we're talking Hanukkah, there's not going to be much to talk about in the Torah. Hanukkah is actually a holiday that's after Tanakh altogether. Yeah. All right, so, but there is an amazing prophecy that we'll read about this coming Shabbat as the Haftarah from Sefer Zechariah. When Zechariah first delivered that prophecy, he professes that he does not understand it. It's so unusual and it is so confounding to him that he doesn't get it. He doesn't understand what he's seeing. The angel has to tell him what he's seeing before he can even try to interpret it, to render a message for his audience. The beginning of Zechariah, and this is the easy part of the book, the first six chapters of Zechariah outline 13 different visions that are meant to be historical predictions for the Jewish people in a world of great upheaval. Right? What the Assyrians and the Babylonians did to the ancient world really cut out whole nations that we just lost. What happened to them happened to our 10 tribes. Right, so this upheaval led to what lost everybody else, but Yehuda and Binyamin came back after 70 years, thanks to the hope that was instilled in the people by Yirmiyahu, when he foretold the destruction, but also reminded them that they would return. So Zechariah is the prophet, the main prophet that realizes Yirmiyahu's predictions. Mm-hmm. In fact, one should not learn Yirmiyahu without learning Zechariah afterwards to recognize that Yirmiyahu's predictions came true. And conversely, I think one shouldn't learn Zechariah, or one can't really learn Zechariah without knowing what predictions these ideas are meant to fulfill. Right? Abravanel, in his commentary to Zechariah, is like a mad scientist. He claims that you can't really understand Zechariah's prophecies unless you are an historian, so that you can identify the prophecies with the unfolding of history. He claims that the first of the visions was right after Zechariah's time, and it goes on, these 13 visions, all the way up to his time. Got it? First vision has three horses chasing after another one. The last vision has a similar prophecy. I think I've told you this before. The first prophecy, according to him, is Alexander the Great giving up his kingdom dividing his kingdom into three. The last one is Columbus taking three ships to a new world. Wow. Now, it would have been nice for Abravanel to take it past the 15th century, but the reason why he didn't is because he wasn't a prophet, right? And he thought that his time, which was the Spanish Inquisition and the expulsion from Spain, was actually leading into the Messianic era. So that's the end. The end of history was 1500, as far as he was concerned. Then the really tough part of Zechariah comes afterwards. Chapter 7 and 8 is a question and an answer.
That's it? Should we continue the fast for the fallen temple when the second one is rebuilt? It's really just the whole two chapters to understand what that question is and to know how to answer it. And then chapter 9 through 14 is very esoteric prophecies. It's one thing to be esoteric with relatively easy Hebrew. It's a whole other thing to be esoteric with impossible Hebrew.
Mm.
Right? That's what the end of Zechariah is. Rashi considered that Zechariah was the most difficult difficult book of the Tanakh. He writes in his introduction to Zechariah that I really don't understand these prophecies. I will render the interpretation of this book according to the Targumim of Yonatan ben Uziel. Mm-hmm. And whatever the rabbis say, because there's really nothing much I can add. The Radak says in his commentary, look, you can see in the story that it seems that Zechariah's audience did not really follow his prophecies, and more. It seems Zechariah himself didn't fully grasp the prophecies. Of course he didn't grasp them. They hadn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, one of those prophecies, we're going to read it, some of it inside, is about two trees, two olive trees, that are, he sees in the vision. Just picture there are two trees here. I don't know if I have a picture of it here. No, I didn't give it to you. I should have. Two olive trees with tubes leading from the olives themselves.
Mm-hmm.
According to some of Farshim, hundreds of them. Right? Whether 7 times 7 times 7, which is 343. Whether there are hundreds or maybe dozens of these tubes leading from these olives into the two ends of a menorah.
Mm-hmm.
And then filling the menorah with oil. That is the vision of Zechariah. And he says to God, what are those two trees? I've never seen such a thing like this. What are they? And God says, they are the sons of oil. Elohim shnei b'nei hayitzhar. Sons of oil. That's the end of the prophecy. The Haftorah of Hanukkah does not get that far down. The Haftorah of Hanukkah just can't go on and on. It's just lane so much.
Oh.
The Haftorah of Hanukkah ends with the words Chuos Chen Chenla, I believe, which is a little before then. But I'm telling you the whole entire vision. And in the middle of that vision, he talks about what is at least interpreted by Chazal as rampant assimilation.
Mm-hmm.
What is in the Haftorah that indicates assimilation is that the Kohen Gadol, who is named, Yoshua Kohen Gadol, he's told to stand and to remove his putrid clothing because he cannot serve God with those putrid clothing. So we have to understand what is the image of a Kohen Gadol, the high priest, wearing putrid, smelly clothing. Tobin, happy birthday.
Thank you.
So some say that what the putrid clothing that the Kohen Gadol was supposed to remove is the fact that for Bayit Sheni during the Second Temple period, the Kohen Gadol did not, for most of that time, have the splendor of the First Temple. Splendor. There was no Shlomo HaMelech to build up. I have a hat and gloves for you in my office, Tobin. That the splendor of Bayit Sheni was not, at least for the beginning of its time, similar to Bayit Rishon. Okay, didn't Chagai say Gadol Yehiyeh Kevod HaBayit Hazeh HaAcharon Min HaRishon?
Mm-hmm.
This house will be better than the first. So Bravanel interprets that to be Bayit Shlishi, because it says HaAcharon. I don't think that that's the Pshat. The Pshat of HaAcharon there means the latter. This latter, L-A-T-T-E-R, this second temple will be greater than the first. That's Rashi's interpretation. It's based on the Gemara, because it lasted longer. And Rashi says it doesn't mean that the whole 420 years or longer that the second temple stood was more splendor than the first. But at the time Herod built it up, Herod made the temple magnificent, and Merat HaMachpelah, he was a tremendous builder. So by the time, and this is a Gemara, and that's not just Pasha Rashi, it's a Gemara in Baba Basra. It says that by the time Herod got finished beautifying the temple, it was more grand than Solomon's. So that's what Chagai meant. Right? But at the time they first built it, it was not. Certainly not. So that's according to some what the putrid clothing of the Kohen Gadol represents. That's Ibn Ezra. Rashi, however, says the putrid clothing of the Kohen Gadol represents the fact that, get this, his sons were intermarried.
Ooh, the Kohen Gadol sons?
How do we know that? Because the intermarriage was so rampant and so pervasive at the time of the return from the Second Temple, to start the Second Temple period, that Ezra and Nehemiah named names. They actually list names of intermarried men. They posted it. That's like a public shaming. Right? And among the names of the intermarried men in both lists were this Yehoshua Kohen Gadol's sons. And they named fathers, so they named the two sons Ben Yehoshua Kohen Gadol.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Is that his fault? I don't know. But those are the putrid clothing. In other words, they're saying you will not be able to start by shaming with the rate of intermarriage. You have to put an end to it right now. Now we're facing such rates now, right? But that's in the Haftorah of Shabbos Chanukah. Plus, amazingly, the prophet, in the middle of all this about of an everlasting source of oil into a menorah flowing from from tubes, from the tree directly into the menorah, and a discussion of rampant assimilation. There's also a pasuk that talks about defeating an enemy, not by your numbers and not by your might, but through the Ruach Hashem. That is a pasuk in Haftarah. So look at, I have three themes of this prophecy. What appears to be, what Zechariah doesn't understand because he hadn't seen it, an everlasting, never-ending source of oil, right? Rampant assimilation, and a battle where we defeat the enemy, not because of our numbers or strength, but because of the Spirit of God. That's the Chanukah story, right? All elements of the Chanukah story. Because some of our original sources only mention the battle, right? Right? Some of our sources only mention the miracle of the oil,
mm-hmm.
right? Al Anisim, when you davened this morning, you said Al Anisim, it doesn't mention anything about the miracle of oil. It just mm-hmm. mentions a battle. And the Gemara that discusses why do we observe Chanukah doesn't mention the battle. It just mentions the oil. Right? So we'll have, maybe at the end we'll have an opportunity to discuss this, so this is the Haftorah that combines all of these elements. So it was natural to have it as the Haftorah of Shabbos Chanukah.
It sounds like a bit of hijacking it to a more religious realm, because Hanukkah is more a political issue. It's more...
So again, it depends on your source. In perhaps the most important source for what happened, which is the Sefer Makkabim, right, also known as the Sefer Chashmonaim, there it's very clear that this starts off as a religious battle. That's the assimilation, the Hellenism, the offering of the pork. That's what gets it started, right? The Greeks didn't want to kill us; they just wanted to love us. They wanted to love us more. That's a bigger problem, right? We've had our enemies that just wanted to kill us no matter what we would do. So that's famous farshim that they say that on Purim, where they wanted to physically destroy us, so we do physical things, we eat, we drink, we get drunk, right? On Chanukah, there wasn't a physical assimilation, annihilation, no. They wanted to love us, they wanted to marry us, they wanted us to marry them. You shouldn't have these differences in your body and your holidays. Just join us, be Hellenistic with us, they saw that it spoke to a lot of Jews, just like it speaks to a lot of Jews today. Right? Well, you're not gonna have a Jewish people for two or three generations as a result. Right? Look, it's all about Jewish continuity. What guarantees that continuity? Right? Okay. Look, we've had Orthodox Jews should not gloat about this because we lost a great continuity in the beginning of in 1920, 1940, 1960 in America. But there is a resurgence on that end for sure, but there are not too many third generation Reform Jews in America. They're either not Jewish or they're Balei Tshuva.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Okay, so I return to my opening statement. You're not going to find too much in the Torah on Hanukkah outright, but there are lots of hints. You see, there's an interesting Gemara. It says, Esther mina Torah minayin. Where can you find Esther hinted in the Torah? Where can you find Haman in the Torah? Where can you find Mordechai in the Torah? Where can you find the Hashem? Why do we do that? You know, do we ever see where do you find Yirmiyahu and Yecheskel in the Torah? No, there's no need to do that. But just because Esther's canonicity was questioned. You know, Esther is not in the Dead Sea Scrolls at all. But we have time to talk about that when we do Purim in February. But the Hanukkah story, you know, was not so broadly accepted at first. Right? It's a nice spiritual story, but remember, at the end of the story, Kohanim became kings. Hashmonai rulers were kings. That's not right. Kohanim are Kohanim. Right? According to the Chasam Sofer, it's an amazing chiddush. There's no reference to the rules of Hanukkah in the Talmud. In the Mishnah. Hanukkah is mentioned in Maseches Shviyos regarding a particular deadline, in Maseches Bikurim regarding a particular deadline also, about when you can bring the Bikurim regarding a Birur date, in Bava Kamma with respect to a particular law about damages. If you're riding a camel on any day of the year and your camel has a big stack of straw that's sticking out, right? And as it's passing a street, it passes a second floor window, and the straw is ignited by fire that's sticking out of that window on any day of the year. That is the damage caused by the owner of the house. But on Hanukkah, says the Mishnah in Maseches Bava Kamma, the damage is on the camel driver, because he should know that on Hanukkah people are going to have fire at their windows.
Oh.
Right? So that's a reference to Hanukkah. Right? The fourth reference is Moed Katan, where it talks about mourning on Hanukkah. So that's it. Just four references, passing references of Hanukkah in the Mishnah. There's a whole Masechta on Purim, Maseches Megillah. Why do you have nothing on Hanukkah? So the Chasam Sofer says an amazing Chiddush. Hanukkah is just a tangent to the laws of lighting Shabbos candles, that tangentially the Talmud, that's 300 years after the Mishnah, tangentially the Talmud discusses my Hanukkah. As a tangent to lighting the Shabbos candles, it talks about the Hanukkah candles and the differences between the rules of the two of them. Shabbos candles are fundamentally for your use, so you have light at your table. Hanukkah candles are fundamentally the opposite. It's at least in the Gemara's conclusion. So the Chasam Sofer says the reason why that Rebbe, the author of the Mishnah, blocked Hanukkah from the Mishnah, except these passing four references, is because Rebbe is a direct descendant of
the Kohen God.
No, the opposite, of David HaMelech.
Oh.
He's from Shevet Yehuda. He's a direct descendant of the dynasty that should have ruled. So he doesn't like the Kohanim that ruled. Well, well before Rebbe, the Hashmonaim turned sour.
Mm.
You know that, right? Hashmonaim kings were turned very bad. In fact, a very famous group purposely left Jerusalem because of how corrupt the Hashmonaim kings were becoming, and they escaped to caves in Qumran, and they're the guys who left us the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Because they despised the rulers that they were wrong in ruling in the first place, even if they were good kings.
Hmm.
Right? They were escaping the corruption of Jerusalem.
Hmm.
Okay. All right, so now what I have given you now on the first two pages, the first page and then page two, you'll see something from Zechariah, is amazingly like the Gemara in that I just mentioned in Chulin. Esther minator minayin, Haman minator minayin, you know, Mordechai minator minayin. Where is Mordechai? Where is Esther in the Torah? There are beautiful hints to these people in the Torah. Why do we do this? Because when people are trying to wipe out Purim, you're going to have to show proofs for Purim, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not just the story itself. That's circular reasoning. I have to have proof for the Purim story outside of the story. Incidentally, it's a very interesting thing. The Dead Sea Scrolls represents all 23 books of the Tanakh in practically their totality, except one. There's one book that has not yet been found, and we pretty much have exhausted all our searches and researches of what was found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. The one book that has no representation to this day is Esther, Megillas Esther. They don't have it. Maybe they didn't hold from it. They didn't like Hanukkah or Purim.
Yeah.
All right? Okay. I mean, look, there's a Gemara that says, when it says that, the last Pasuk, it says that Mordechai was loved by Rov Echov. Most of his brothers liked him. What does that mean? He won an election? Right? All right, so I don't think that Rov Echov there means most of it in Pshat. The Gemara darshans. Rav Echav means by the multitudes of his brethren.
Uh-huh.
But the Gemara still darshans. Pirshu mimenu miktsa Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was not happy with the end of the story of Purim. Because Mordechai and Esther, in that position of power, led to rampant assimilation in Persia. And what did millions, I tell you, millions, and I know that number. I'll tell you why I know that number. Millions of Jews did not heed Yirmiyahu's call. Or Haggai's call, or Zechariah's call, or Malachi's call, or Ezra Nehemiah's call. What was the call? To do what? No.
42,000.
Right, only 42,000 came. Right, so I know the numbers that didn't come. Right? Because life was so good in the exile. That's so good for them. That's such a crazy number. 42,000 is a small tribe 1,000 years ago. Only 42,000, 360 to be exact, by the way. So so few Jews returned. So they weren't happy with the end of the Purim story, Kiviyocho. Right? Yes.
Maybe they weren't happy with the whole Golistic nature of it and what you just said, that Rabbi Mordechai always said that he went to affairs of state parties where everything was glatt kosher and sealed, but he was there drinking with them his own wine. And he was into it too much. And that's why it was the Rov Echav. That's the other interpretation, that he wasn't that beloved.
Yeah.
But also the description of the Mishneh Yayin, of 3-day parties, of all sorts of stuff that would lead you towards where the Greeks were with their Dionysian ecstasies and their the Cholul was the loss to nature.
What you're saying is absolutely what is happening in the first parak of Esther. Everything is written in the Megillah to show that Shushan has replaced Yerushalayim, Achashverosh's court has replaced the temple court, right? The terminologies, the temple terminologies, the Mishkan terminologies that they're using to show Achashverosh's splendor, and the fact that only two cities in the whole Tanakh are called Bira, Shushan Abira and Yerushalayim Abira, it shows that this is exactly what's happening. It's almost like a parody. It's like a satire of how what the Jews have allowed to happen to them.
Maybe the Chassidish Drosh or Shimshon Rafal Hirsch, that we have Sasson as opposed to Shalem.
So Shimshon
Sasson, Shalem, completeness.
Right. So that's Shimshon does some
pleasure as opposed to completeness.
Yeah. Yeah. Samach and see, yeah, okay.
I mean, the
good.
Spelling's off, but that's
yeah, no, that's good.
It works. I have in the
it works. Okay, so here, what I would like to do, however, is in light of the Gemara, it's not a Gemara in Megillah, it's a Gemara in Chulin. In light of the Gemara, looking, grasping for all references to Purim in the Torah, so now I'm giving you some references to Hanukkah in the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhat, now, and I'm not going to Rashi first, I'm going to Sadyagon. Sadyagon is a great philosopher. He's well before Rashi, right? And he writes that there is a hint to the Chanukah story in these psukim. Look at Levi's bracha at the end of the Torah. Ula Levi Omar. You see what I'm reading? The first source in the front. Tumecha ve'urecha, like the Urim v'tumim. Le'ish chasidecha asher nisiso b'masa t'ruveyu al-mei meriva. This is Moshe talking to his own tribe. Right?
This is also a bracha, right?
Yeah. Right.
It says Haftorah, but this is the
Chumash,
no?
No. It says Haftorah Shabbos Chanukah is what this is about in Zechariah, but this is now starting in the Torah. So I'm going to skip to Yudalef because it talks about the great praises of this whole tribe because they kept God's covenant when the others didn't, and they were the teachers, they were the guides, right? The last pasuk says, Borech Hashem Chelo. May God bless his Chayil. Now, Chel can mean strength in Hebrew. It means it in Aramaic, actually, right? What it means here, according to Sadyagon, is may God bless the army of the Levites. Now, what would army would that be? When did Levi comprise an army? In Shechem, and when after that?
Maccabees.
The Maccabees. They would go on him. Shevet Levi. Right? So may God bless the army of Shevet Levi. Now, Leviim, the Rambam Paskins actually in the laws of Shemitah B'Yovel, that Shevet Levi ein orchen lemilchama. They do not set up, they don't go to the battle. Right? Because it wouldn't be fair. They don't, why do you go to battle? To increase your land. They don't have land, so why should they go to battle? However, that seems to be contradicted by laws elsewhere in the Rambam. For instance, where the Rambam says that a yafas toar is mutter to a kohen. How does that prove that not only Levim, even Kohanim go to war?
Mm.
Levi, the kohen, a kohen is a small part of Levi, right? Kohanim do go to battle. How do we know from the Rambam? Because where else does a man see a fas toar?
Mm.
And I'm talking about it says in the beginning of the Seitzah, the captured woman in battle, and you take her home, and you cut her hair, and you cut her nails, right? So the question is, you might think a Kohen shouldn't take such a woman, because a Kohen is not allowed to marry even a convert. Mm-hmm. This woman is converting shortly if she wants to stay. If not, you have to set her free. Send her back to her family. But how can a Kohen marry her? So the answer is, it's a chiddush. Now, Yafas Toar is only allowed in battle, not Stamazoi. This would revolutionize the whole, right? It's only in battle. So if the Rambam Paskins, a Kohen may marry Yafas Toar, you following? It must be that he goes to battle. There's another proof of this is, and I'm getting off on a bit of a tangent here, But the Torah says that just before a battle, the Kohen announces, "Who just planted a vineyard? Go home and dedicate it. Let someone else do it. Who just built a house and didn't have the chance to dedicate it yet? Go home. Let someone right." And it also says, "Who's within the first year of marriage and who got engaged? Who just got engaged and didn't have a chance to consummate the marriage? Go home and don't fight this battle, right?" So then the Gemara says, this is only true, these last two cases, if the marriage is one sanctioned by the halacha. Got it? But if it's a marriage that's not sanctioned by the halacha, and the Mishnah, this is a Mishnah, the Mishnah gives an example, such as a Kohen who's marrying a divorcee. If this Kohen is marrying a divorcee, he does not get to go home with all the other ones getting married. So is the Rambam Paskins this way. So isn't it obvious from the Rambam that the Kohen is in battle? Right? Where else is he hearing this announcement? You following? You hear it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what does the Rambam say that a Levim don't go to battle? So the answer is Levim don't have to go to battle. Because it's not fair that they're not going to gain the benefits of the battle. Should he survive? So of course the Levim don't have to go to battle, but if there's a Milchames Mitzvah or some kind of other battle I'm being disingenuous because at a Milchames Mitzvah there is no Yafas Toar and there is no announcement like this from a Milchames Mitzvah, meaning obligatory war for self-defense or against a Molek or the Seven Nations of Canaan. But other wars, they wouldn't do such a thing. So Kal v'chomer, if a Kohen is fighting optional wars where they do announce go home or you can take a Yafas Toar, surely they go to obligatory wars, right? Okay. So I'm just trying to say, why would Moshe say Baruch Hashem Chelo? The commentaries who say that Chelo here does not mean his army, but it means his strength, because Levites don't fight in the army, they are categorically wrong. Levites do fight in the army. Even Kohanim fight in the army. You following? I'm just trying to tell you that based on what I just said in the last 5 minutes, it's perfectly acceptable, as Sadia Gaon does, to translate, may God bless the army of the Shevet Levi. But hold on, it gets better. It says, Upol Yadav Tirtze, and God, whatever Levi does, you should want it. All right, that does not necessarily refer to an army. But then look what it says afterwards. Mechatz masnayim kamav umisanav minu kamun. May he... Machatz means to strike away. What?
Erase?
Okay, it could be from the memches, macha. That's it. No, but it's very good. It seems to be the approach of Rashi, that if you change the third letter, it doesn't
change the root.
change the basic etymology too much. It's a big chiddush, right? That machatz and macha should be something similar, but they're probably etymologically connected, right? Okay, so machak, machal maybe, which is not a biblical word, by the way. Machal, to forgive, means I'm erasing your sin to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? It's a big chiddush. So when it says, may he smite the loins of those who rise up on him, and his enemies should not be able to get to rise. Right? Now, so Sadia Gaon says an amazing chiddush. He claims that this reference. You want to read it now? Okay. So this is Sadia Gaon in his perush. Look at the second line right after the five. It would be line six. Ki pasuk ze nevuah al nitzachon b'nei chashmonai hakohanim shehem mizera Levi. It's a blessing to the army of Levites. Right? Because Moshe, with his great prophetic abilities, was aware that Shevet Levi would lead this rebellion against the Greeks. And how does this Al Yevanim? Why does he say that this refers to Greeks? This is an amazing chiddush. Are you familiar with a dream of Nebuchadnezzar? A dream he forgot, but he knew it bothered him? Mm-hmm. It relates to this week's parsha with Paro, right? At least Paro remembered his dream. He just wasn't satisfied with any of the interpretations people gave him. But if you remember the story in Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar had a very disturbing dream. He woke up and he wanted its interpretation. But there's one little problem.
He couldn't tell anybody what it was.
He didn't remember what it was. So he calls in all his magicians, 100 magicians. He tells, I want an interpretation of this dream. And they told him 2-3 times, O King of Kings, no magician on planet Earth can tell you what your dream is. What we can do is, if you tell us the dream, interpret it for you. So he says, what am I paying you guys for? I'm going to kill every last one of you unless I get a dream and its interpretation. And don't fabricate one. I'll know what it's not.
Mm.
When I hear the dream, I will know what it is. So don't make up a dream. You're all dead tomorrow unless someone satisfies me with a dream.
And that was Daniel.
Now, look how anti-Semitism works in the world. A powerful lesson of anti-Semitism. When Daniel prays to God, please inform me of the dream so that I can save everybody and I can interpret the dream. You'd think that when he does, and he very much satisfies, that they'd all be grateful. No, they're
angry.
Jealous and angry at the Jew who upstages us. There's nothing we could do short of walking one by one into an oven or into the Mediterranean to satisfy the anti-Semites who really hate us. What are we going to do? See, I don't have horns under this yarmulke. I'm not really a pig. I'm not really trying to steal everything from you. I'm not a monkey. I'm not, right? You're going to try to show them? Right? So, I know, Holocaust survivor children tend to think this way. I'm sorry. Maybe I'm jaded. But there are too many people like this that are gaining traction in the world and getting followers.
Yeah, there was just
followers.
An incident in Sweden.
Sweden again? Yeah. Okay. Sweden, which is supposed
to
be neutral.
They attacked
the shore. Yeah.
No, Sweden had the race rules before the Nazis.
Yeah. Although Sweden wasn't conquered by the Nazis, they stayed.
Yeah.
They didn't need to be. They were on their side without being conquered.
The Norwegians and the Scandinavians were conquered, but the Swedes.
Right, Scandinavia, they hate the Swedes because they let the Germans have their troop trains go through Sweden up to Norway, where they were developing an atomic bomb.
Okay, so Lemaisa. So in the dream, Daniel tells him the dream, and he's satisfied. He says, "Yes, I remember. That's it. You must be something special. You saved everybody. Now interpret it for me." Now the interpretation was not as positive as Yosef's. Yosef's interpretation made Paro happy.
I'll
be able to prepare myself for the bad stuff, right? Because the other guys are all going to say, you know, only hunky-dory interpretations. Yosef says, "Listen, I want you to be sober and careful about how to deal with what's inevitable." Right? Nebuchadnezzar's dream was basically of a figure where as you go up the figure, everything in it becomes more and more dear and precious. Starts off as mud, stone, brass, silver, gold, right? The head is Nebuchadnezzar, because you are the greatest conqueror of all time. But everything is going to have its day. And your own life will last very nicely. But it's not a kingdom that will last in perpetuity. There's another kingdom after you, right? And that's you're the head. That kingdom is the chest and the shoulders. And then there's a kingdom after it, which is the trunk. That's known as Masnayim. You get it?
Mm-hmm.
Who's the head? Nebuchadnezzar. Who's the shoulders? Give me a nation.
Us.
Who conquered the Babylonians? Come on.
Persians.
Come on. Persians. Those were good guys, by the way. They treated us very well. Darius, Cyrus, Artaxerxes, Ahasuerus.
They treated us too well.
Who conquered them? You know your history?
The Greeks.
So if Hashem tells, if Moshe says, "May God bless the army of Levi, that they should smite the trunk, the Masnayim."
They're talking about the Ivani, Greeks.
That's a Torah blessing that an army of Levites, Kohanim are Levites, should conquer the Greeks. That's because they were able to because Moshe gave them the blessing here that they should do it. That's Sa'ad Yigon's parish. Isn't that amazing? Hanukkah's right here in the Torah. Okay? Now,
could it be that this thing of the interpretation of Chelo, Hashem's God's army, that it's his strength, is the argument that's made that B'nai Torah aren't supposed to serve in the army in Israel? Are they using this?
I just had someone in my office come this Friday night to hear him. He's going to talk Friday night. He's going to talk on Shalosh Shodes. He adopted 24 children. 24. He showed me pictures. He has 24 kids that he adopted. He has a long beard. He's a Haredi Jew. And he adopts children whose parents disavow of them because they want to join the army. The guy who was here, he only speaks Hebrew, but the guy who was here, he said, you know, he's pretty clean, you know, he has a small, short beard, but he's wearing, of course, a yarmulke. But he said, "I was Haredi like everybody else. My parents didn't let me go to my sister's wedding. They know I'm sleeping outdoors. They don't care. And this guy brought me in. Now I have an apartment, and I live with others like me, 24 so far. And their parents just totally rejected them because they want to serve in the army.
They're off their derech.
They're all 24 of them are on.
They're off the Haredi. Their
parents say you can't serve in the army if you want. Now there are Haredi units now that they could serve in, but the parents say even that it's so treif and so puzzle. So look, what can I say? When Yahushua fought the battles, you have to learn Torah too. We have to be spiritual so that Hashem favors us. But to say that everyone serves in, has to sit in the base of Medrash, everyone who's a Torah Jew has to sit in the base of Medrash, then Yahushua wouldn't have conquered Israel in the beginning.
Saying everyone in life in general doesn't work.
No, if you say there's some very special, very talented, then there's maybe some, but everybody?
Right. There's always going to be an exception to the rule.
All right. Look, I don't want to, you know, alienate. Okay. So, but let me know. I want to give you some nosh. Look at this nosh. I'm on the first page here. Look at the 25th word of the Torah. I'll save you time. I wrote a 25 on top of it.
Okay, it's
or. 25 or 50.
Now, I'm sorry, the bottom line here. It just happens to be the bottom line. Israel took 42 journeys in the desert.
Okay.
The 25th journey, it's blocked out, was a place called Hashmona.
Oh, wow.
The 25th journey is called Hashmona. Is that amazing?
Yeah.
Okay, now let's take a look at this week's parasha. When Yosef set up food for his brothers, this is the right side at the top. It says, Utvoach tevach vehochein. They slaughtered meat and prepared it for the brothers. There's no doubt that the author of Maoz Tzur took his words from here. La'eis tochin matbeach mitzor hamnabe. It was meant to rhyme with mizbeach.
Okay.
Right? So how many words in the Bible rhyme with mizbeach? Matbeach means a slaughter. Just as the slaughter was being prepared, God, from the barking, biting enemy, ozeg mor b'shir mizmor chanukas hamizbeach. In the midst of that, we were able to defeat the enemy and rededicate God's. Right? You see what I wrote inside? La'eis tochin matbeach mitzor hamanabeach. But it gets better than that. Look at you see the words utvoach tevach, you see it?
Yeah.
Look at the last five letters, including the chet of that word.
Oh, that's Hanukkah if you mix it up.
Right. You see it?
Yeah.
What's the and look at the gematria of the word utvoach.
Where is that?
Utvoach is 25.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the first two letters outside of Hanukkah in addition. Tet Bet.
That's
another 11. Nine. What's 25 and 11 that has to do with Hanukkah?
The number of candles.
The number of candles we light. Your box gets 44 because
for the Shamas.
But 8 factorial, eight back to 1,
plus 7 plus 6
is 36. So you have the word Hanukkah. Right? Are you following me with those? Utvoach is 25. That's the day of the month again. To add the Tet Bet besides the word Hanukkah, and you get 36. This is right now. I admit that if you have enough time and a computer, you could probably. But this is old. This is old stuff. This is from a long time ago. Right? Now, when Yosef identifies himself to his brothers, he gives Chamesh Yodos.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he gives to Binyamin. Chamesh Yodos. Why does it call it that? Five hands?
Kippurim.
Chamesh Yodos?
Oh.
Because it's Kippurim Biyad Chaloshim, Rabim Biyad Ma'atim, Tmeyim Biyad Teorim. You get it?
Mm-hmm.
There are five Yodos in Alanisim. Everyone see it? Make sure you see it.
You say that there are five stages in Paro's dream, too.
Chalamot Paro.
What does that have to do with five? What are the five different stages?
Chalamot Paro.
I can't remember.
Yeah. Al Yad Hayor. I think the word Yad appears five times in this dream, maybe.
So Milat Mancha?
Biad.
To the left.
Uh-huh.
In your handwriting. Yeah. But in Paro's dream, I have to
Those are the ones from Alanisim. But it also seems to be connected to Paro's dream, where the word Yad might appear five times.
Yeah, I have to check that. Come on.
You want a Tanakh? What parak is it in?
It's the beginning of Miketz. So let's just see quickly. And this week's parasha is really where all these dreams, all these. So I'll. Al Hayor, it doesn't say Al Yad Hayor, so I don't know.
Mm.
Yeah.
Does it say Yor five times?
No, I'd have to make a.
Figure out why you put that there?
Figure out why I put that there, yeah. Maybe the word Chalom appears five times, I don't know. It has to be significantly more more connected than that. Okay. So
maybe it's what the dreams were about. The cat.
Yeah. Well, that fits Hanukkah very well. Because both dreams,
the week.
Right. That's it. That must be it. The dreams of Paro are about something gaunt and
overtaking
something that's much bigger than it. Yeah, and Robinson got it, that's for sure.
It's the theme of the dreams.
That's what it's there. You get it? Okay. Something, the ears of corn are so, you know, worn out. So that's the Chanukah story.
Oh, that's what you're saying. Look, right. Even the way you wrote it. These Chamesh Yadzot can be seen Chalam as a
Paro.
Theme in
right.
Chalam of
Paro. Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Okay. All right. I'm always lost without the Rebbetzin. All right. So, at Sof Parshas Miketz, at the end of every Parsha of the Torah, it tells you how many Psukim are in that Parsha.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's 146 Psukim in Parshas Miketz.
Okay.
All right? So, the only Parsha where the Mesorah tells us how many words are in the Parsha is, it says, you see at the end, I underlined it, V'tevot Alpayim Chofei, 2025. So what is 2025? So I got that number, 25 again, you got it?
Yeah.
2000 is the Gematria of Ner, which is 250, you get it? Ner.
Mm-hmm.
I'm making this up right now. 250 times 8 equals 2,000, right? And then you have the extra 25 for Chafei. Right, you get it?
Wow.
Ner is 250 times 8 Neros is 2,000, and the 25 is the Chafei. Right? So, Zechariah, where we started, I wrote assimilation, right, like Nehemiah, right? Okay. Okay. So you have the never-ending supply of oil.
Mm-hmm.
You have the Rabim Biad Me'atim.
Right.
Right. What about the Shnei B'nei HaYitzhar, those two sons of oil? What is that? Why do they have sons of oil? What does that even mean? So here, there's a Gemara in the Maseches Sukkah that says that it refers to Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. There are two Mashiachs for us. Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. Because there are some conflicting descriptions of the redemptive figure in Tanakh. So Christians say one is the first coming, one is the second coming. Jews say, no, there are two Mashiachs. Why? Because there are two kingdoms. All over Tanakh, Yechezkel has a vision of two trees, and he says, put Ephraim on one, put Yehuda on the other, and these are the two kingdoms, right? These two trees are the same thing, right? We have Mashiach ben Yosef, who sets up and precedes Mashiach ben David, maybe by hundreds of years. The Vilna Gaon thought people who make Aliyah and build up the land of Israel are Mashiach ben Yosef. Okay? So those are the two trees. So why is the holiday called Chanukah, and why did we need 8 nights? Why didn't the oil last for 17 nights, or 4 nights, or 12 nights? Was something special about the number 8?
Do you know all of the words? Like 7 days?
Word so 7 created, 7 is natural, 8 goes to like supernatural. So fine, all the 8s can we can say that. But there's a simple practical reason. What do you mean they didn't have oil? Go to the Beis Hamikdash today and look to your east, right? What do you see? It's a name for the mountain. It's called Mount of Olives. Harazesim. Why didn't they just go to Harazesim and squeeze new grapes, new olives? So right. The Ran says the Greeks cut them all down. There weren't any. All right, but still, it's Harazesim, and it's called that in Tanakh. It's a mountain. They have olives there. They were there. No, squeezing new olives wouldn't work for them. If the temple hasn't been in order for scores of years, and now we try to rededicate it, what's the first thing you have to do?
Clean it up.
Clean it up, and that they've been doing all this time.
You need pure oil.
You need pure oil, squeezed by pure people.
Yeah.
Oh, no one is pure.
No one's pure. What do you need that to make yourself pure? Something that they probably...
They had tumah. They didn't have the...
Tumah. They need the paraduma. But they had the ashes in the base of Mikdash. Mm-hmm. It's just that you need 7 days after you start to purify yourself in order to squeeze new oil to be used in the temple. Otherwise, you touch the oil, it's now tumah like you.
Right.
So that's why they needed 8 days. Do
that's
the deed.
Why Hanukkah is 8 days.
7 more days, and on the 8th day, go up to Mount Olives and squeeze all the oil you want. Isn't that amazing? Right? So that's the Lashon of Chinuch, means to put to use. Chinuch means to, okay, I think we'll close with that. This is a little too complicated, the Psikta Rabasi at the end. But he just wanted, the point is that with all these hints from the Torah, it gives us the koach and the strength to recognize that what we're doing is predicted and will succeed. Okay, thank you so much, everyone.
Eight?
I'm sorry?
You can just back to number 8 because David is the 8th
thing
in the family.
Okay, that's
interesting.
He has seven older brothers, yes.
Yeah.
That's a nice number. Okay, everybody. A great day. Stay warm.